It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the future of food might be insect. We'll learn about edible bugs and why we should maybe give them a try. First, in a world where more and more of our time is being spent online, wouldn't online friendships only seem natural? Sure, it might look different than traditional friendship, where we actually see each other in person. Is it time for our idea of friendship to catch up, or is it possible that online friendships can never be the same as sitting face-to-face? Our next guest tackles those questions in a recent piece in the New York Times. Stephen Asma is a professor of philosophy and founding fellow of the research group in Mind, Science, and Culture at Columbia College Chicago. He's the author of several books, including his latest, The Emotional Mind. He wrote the piece, "This Friendship Has Been Digitized," for the New York Times. Stephen, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, what started you thinking about digital friendship versus, in-person friendship?
Well, I have a son who's around 15 years old, and I was watching him playing a video game with his friends online, and, you know, he's jumping around with the controller, and I was talking to him about it, and he's playing with his friend. Now, his friend is named Scuzzball. You know, they all have these kind of internet monikers. And there's like a little avatar picture of the kid. And I said, "Oh, who is this guy?" And he said, "Oh, he's been playing with him for a few years." I'd heard the name before too. I said, "What do you know about him?" And he said, "Oh, he lives in France." And then he was like, no, he lives in Canada. And then I find out, well, he doesn't know what age he is. He doesn't know where he lives. He doesn't know anything about him. And then when I was sort of teasing him about this, his friend was actually replaced in the game by an artificial intelligence robot. So when you leave the game, let's say his friend has to go to dinner or something, all of a sudden a robot comes in and just starts playing and finishes that sort of tour of duty with you. And my son wasn't bothered in the least that his friend was replaced by an AI robot. And I thought, well, in what sense are they friends? Like, it's so different from the kind of friendship that old folks like me grew up with. So that's what got me thinking about it.
And you start, in a way, by using your philosophy background to try to break down, well, what is a friend? So skipping the video games for now and the digital media world, what are some of the key characteristics of being a friend?
Well, one of the sort of key philosophical ideas on friendship comes from Aristotle. And he said there were three kinds of friendships. One was a friendship of pleasure. This is just your buddy who you'd like to go out partying with, but you wouldn't share the deep stuff with them. And then there's friendships of utility, where you use them, they use you, sort of like the work friendship where you have to solve, you know, issues together. Maybe you need a ride and then you can cook for them or something. And then finally, there's this deeper friendship, which he says is where you care about the other person for her sake or for his sake, not for anything that you get out of it. And so I start by looking at this idea. And then I agree, this is very old-fashioned. Does the digital life change this stuff? And I came up with three criteria for defining a friendship. I said, you have to have shared experience. So in other words, you have to do things together. Two, you have to have some kind of loyalty or some kind of bonding. And three, you have to have a shared mental experience you can share in each other's mental life, shared intentionality. And you can see, like, when your dog, you might think your dog is your friend, and you come in after a long day at work and your dog curls up next to you, and there's no doubt your dog is loyal. You know, nothing's more loyal than a dog. But your dog can't tell that you didn't get that. You can't tell your dog, I didn't get that promotion at work. I'm thinking about becoming an atheist. I don't like the current politics. The dog can't enter into your mental life. And so I think you need these three ingredients all together to have a real friendship.
So let's apply that to the online world now. Now, it seems like it might be hard to pull off with, say, a shooting game like your son was playing, but there's a lot of different ways we connect on forums, on social media, things like that. Can we satisfy those objectives of friendship online and purely online?
Well, I think people are confused about the kind of pleasures that we're having online and in friendships. And one of the things that happens when you're engaged online is you get a spike of dopamine. So it feels good, you know, when you're sort of having a good social media experience with your friends or even playing these games. But bonding or loyalty is a different set of neurochemicals and neurotransmitters. Like, that's basically a product of oxytocin and internal opioids like endorphins. And those are the things that don't get triggered as much during sort of online life. So I definitely think there's a degree here. Like if you're having a face-to-face experience with a friend, like you're both...
Speak to the Christians who you know in Sri Lanka, do they see this as...
Okay, some weird technical quirks here. Sorry, please do go on.
That's right. So like if you're having a face-to-face experience with friends like at summer camp, that's a very high oxytocin, high endorphin sort of experience. But then you can imagine like a next layer down or next degree down would be like embodied or virtual reality kinds of experiences where you have the goggles, you have the suit on, and you and your friend who's in another country are solving some problem together. That's got a lot of embodied, you know, oxytocin endorphins as well. Then you could go another layer down, and that would be like playing console games and app games where it's not quite as embodied as these other forms. And then finally, something like social media or email where you're just liking each other's posts or you have sort of a pen pal. That can be very satisfying, and it's a kind of friendship, but it's not as embodied as these other forms.
Talking to Stephen Asma, professor of philosophy at Columbia College, Chicago. Talk about a piece he wrote in the New York Times about friendship, digital friendship, online friendship versus the other, more familiar kind. Stephen, one thing you mentioned in that earlier philosophical definition of friendship is somebody being caring for you when you need it. If I can quote a popular treatise on friendship, I'll be there for you. From the theme song to Friends, are we getting that from a digital friend, a social media friend, in a way that we might give from an in-person friend? You give the example of, you know, that person who brings you soup when you're sick.
Yeah, it's a good question. I've been trying to find some kind of measure of this among younger people, you know, teens who are using the media a lot. And the example I came up with was okay, you have friends and... But how many people would come and, you know, bring you soup tonight if you were sick and you called them up? And I was asking my students, college students, this question. They were laughing at me because they said, well, I don't have to have anybody. I can just call Uber Eats or Grubhub and they'll just deliver it to me. And I got to thinking about this. And there is this phenomenon in Japan now of very intense social isolation called hikikomori. And these are young people. They're not old timers. They're young people, and they're living as recluses. They work on computer at home. They sort of engage with their so-called friends online. They have all their food ordered to them, and they never leave their houses. So one worry I have is the young people, you know, in their teens, Gen X, millennials, and Gen Z rather. They might not know the difference between what they're calling a friendship and this more sort of dedicated, loyal experience where the person will make big sacrifices for you. So that's unclear.
Steve, one thing I love about your piece is you spend most of it skeptical about online friendship. But at the end, you try to flip things around and make the case that, well, maybe we need to change the way we think of friendship. So I guess make the counter argument, even if you don't quite buy it.
Yeah, I've been called the Steven Spielberg of op-eds because I have this sort of not happy ending on this piece where I basically look at it's a pretty amazing case of this young man named Matt Steen who had muscular dystrophy, and he's living in the Netherlands, if I recall correctly. Now, his body is degenerating in terms of what he can do, and eventually he can't leave the house. Or his wheelchair, but he's living a very fulfilled life in digital space. He's a well-respected and loved character in World of Warcraft. He has these devoted friends who don't know anything about his illness. And then this is really the optimistic point is that after this young man died, and of course that's tragic, but what was remarkable was that his friends came from all around Europe to the funeral to pay their respects to him. And the reason why this is optimistic is it suggests that there was some deep bonding that occurred for them, even entirely through this sort of digital medium. So, you know, that's at least one case where you can see something substantial happening and the sort of magic of friendship happening despite no face-to-face contact.
We're talking to Stephen Asma, a professor of philosophy and founding fellow of the research group in mind, science, and culture at Columbia College, Chicago. He wrote the piece, This Friendship Has Been Digitized, for the New York Times, looking at in-person friendship versus online friendship. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like you have online-only friends who maybe mean as much to you as, I don't want to say the real thing if you think that, but as what we think of as a friend? Do you have circles of friends on gaming sites, say, or on social media? Or do you worry that we spend too much time online with people we know, not enough time in person, that we can't fulfill the functions of friendship online only? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Stephen Asma. He's a professor of philosophy at Columbia College Chicago. He wrote the piece, "This Friendship Has Been Digitized," for the New York Times. We're talking about how the digital world has changed our idea of friendship. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have friends that you only talk with online, or maybe that you keep up with online? Does it feel the same as getting together with a person? Do you worry that we spend too much time with our online friends, not enough time with our friends in person? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Steve, is there a happy meeting point here where you could see some people are using that social media to stay in touch and to arrange that get-together with maybe their gaming friends or the people in the club or the friends from high school or whatever? Can we use the two back and forth to support each other?
Yeah, I think it's true that especially if you've already forged a friendship with someone, then online life is really... It really amplifies those connections. It's really fun to stay in contact with people and to stay on top of what they're doing. But frequently that works best when you already have some kind of bond, like, okay, you went to school with this person, or you were classmates, you were on a sports team together, or maybe you're in a music group or something. Those kinds of connections can only be strengthened. But my concern is whether or not you can build a really lasting and deep friendship from the ground up in digital space, entirely online. And I know that people claim they have, and they do, but I have my doubts about this, I guess. I am skeptical. I mean, I suppose if my Facebook started slowly being replaced by AI bots, I'm not sure I would notice, and I'm not sure this would be that troubling, because it would just be, cat video, funny meme, political rant, repeat, and, this kind of thing.
Let's bring on a caller now. We've got David on the line in Madison. David, hi.
Good afternoon.
What do you want to tell us about, David?
Well, my wife is very active on social media, and, she's had the experience of meeting a lot of people all over the world. And some of that has led to, phone conversations and even the prospect of, going to visit. So I think, contrary to what your guest was just saying, I think that at least in her experience, she's actually finding this really rewarding to be able to meet people online and develop relationships.
I got to ask, David, is your wife the kind of person who in person is really good at meeting people and, turning strangers into friends?
Well, I think it's selectively. I think that's true. Yes.
All right, David, thank you so much for that call. So people maybe with the impetus, Steve, can start with that online point and gradually, like, you'd build a friendship with maybe, a coworker, maybe build that online friendship into something bigger.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. I mean, oftentimes in this sense, I see social media is sort of like what the phone was, back in the day. You used the phone frequently to set up a meeting with your friends, and then you got together with them and you had all the kind of bonding that I'm talking about here. But sometimes people they don't want to meet in person. The phone conversation is enough. My own fear is that phone conversations and digital experiences online are much safer, much more comfortable, much more less threatening. And my worry is that people will prefer that because they want to be comfortable and safe all the time. But real friendship requires this like messy emotional entanglement, and it's not always comfortable. And sometimes you have to serve your friend, and it's not convenient. And that's my worry, is that people who who might tend towards isolation might be more isolated, and maybe more gregarious people will simply use it as a tool to meet others.
David, thanks for the call. Going out to Kylie with us in Sparta. Kylie, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Kylie?
Well, as I told your screener, I have a little bit of a different perspective. I am on the autism spectrum, and so the social media aspect is actually awesome for me. Although everybody on my social media is someone I do know in real life, but as far as staying with communicating with those people, if I didn't have social media, that really wouldn't happen as much for me.
Kylie, so, do you feel more comfortable interacting with people on social media than you might in person?
Yeah, a lot more. 'Cause I don't have to, you know, there's just so many other things that, like, when you're out and about that you just have to pick up on with conversations. And if you're doing something at the same time, you know, like if you go out bowling, you know, you can't really focus on any conversations or anything, like, because there's just so much going on, you know?
Mm-hmm. Kylie, thank you so much for sharing that story. So in Kylie's case, Steve, she does interact. These are people she's known in person, but this is kind of a level playing field for interacting online in some ways.
Yeah, I support that entirely. And I do think there are these sort of unique or special cases. I mean, there's a wonderful autism conference where the various people who go will wear a badge. And if they flip the badge towards one color, like red, then it means, you know, I'm willing to have a conversation, you know, feel free to approach me. And if you flip the badge to the other color, let's say blue, it's saying, you know, I'm not feeling like I want to talk to people right now. And this strikes me as a wonderful technique, not just for people on the autism spectrum, but anybody who's shy and introverted. And so I can totally get that digital space and interaction is a kind of safe and very comfortable place to build relationships. I guess my general point still stands that I think you end up getting a bit more, you know, of this kind of bonding when you have shared, you know, embodied space. But I take the caller's point. It's an excellent point.
Kylie, thanks a lot for sharing your experience. We're talking to Stephen Asma, philosophy professor from Columbia College Chicago, looking at online friendships and real-life friendships, offline friendships, and what we might be missing. And Steve, I think a key point you're making, I don't think at any point in your piece you say, don't do the online stuff. You're more worried about it crowding out everything else and what we might lose.
That's right. I mean, one sort of view would be that you can't have friendships at all and you should stay away from being online. It's more rather that people are drawn to this kind of interaction because it's providing the kind of dopamine hit that, frankly, that something like cocaine provides people. I mean, it's actually, you know, there's actually childcare. The American Academy of Pediatrics has sort of warned against internet gaming disorder, and the reason why they're saying is because it's incredibly addicting. Now, the reason why that's a problem is because it's drawing you away from going out and doing other things like playing with your friends outside or engaging in other activities. You simply get drawn in and it replaces the other kinds of sort of paradigms of friendship that we have.
Do you, Steve, see maybe your son, your students having a backlash, maybe saying, hey, we do need more time in person with each other?
I actually gave my students an assignment, which was to do a digital diet, which means 2 days, no phone, and then they have to write about what they experienced. And the result was fascinating. Many of them were incredibly irritated. And it was like they were going through withdrawal, you know, just very upset and anxious, you know, just expecting some great text is coming, some email, but then eventually they realized, oh, they were attending more carefully to their families who were talking to them. They were actually sort of more involved in the family life that was happening in the home. And many of them recognized that it was making them more present in the world to be off the digital devices, even for a short time, like 2 days.
What is your worry? I don't want to end necessarily on a negative note, but what is your worry if we do keep moving toward replacing in-person friendships with online friendships? Where do you see us going, not just as individuals, but as a society?
Well, I think the scary thing is that other technological advances are coming online here sort of in the wings, one of which is robotics, and the other of which is increasingly complex AI, so that the level of interaction with artificial intelligence will be increasingly sophisticated. So what I'm worried about is people will get off from work. In 20 years, I can imagine people coming home from work and they have a robot instead of a husband or a wife. And that robot is, you know, programmed to say just the right things to make you feel good enough to get to the next day. And that's the kind of creepy, you know, vaguely, you know, Aldous Huxley, George Orwell potential that's there. I don't know whether that's going to happen, but it's a possibility.
And leave us with an optimistic note. Do you think we will steer clear of that vaguely dystopian outcome?
Well, I think this, even this little experiment I did with my students where they did the digital diet, I'm beginning to see that young people are taking breaks themselves. That, you know, they're putting a control on their phone that stops it after so many hours. They're even some of the designers in Silicon Valley are trying to create apps that will put you back out into the world, not back into the games over and over again. So I think we're getting a little wiser over the last few years, and I think that trend could continue.
Stephen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Stephen Asma is professor of philosophy and founding fellow of the research group in mind, science, and culture at Columbia College, Chicago. He's the author of several books, including his latest, The Emotional Mind. He talked with us about our changing friendships in the digital age. You can find his piece, This Friendship Has Been Digitized, for the New York Times. Coming up after the news, we'll visit with a self-described edible insect ambassador who's bringing his message of eating bugs here to Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look at how to prevent young people from becoming recruits for terrorist movements around the world. First, Swarm to Table is a three-day event later this week on the UW-Madison campus, and it focuses on promoting insects as a food source for humans. It includes an art show, cooking demos, a gourmet dinner, and a bug and beer pairing. One of the featured presenters is Chef Joseph Yoon. He's the executive director of Brooklyn Bugs and an edible insect ambassador. Swarm to Table is one stop in a multi-city college tour he's on. Chef Yoon, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Now, in a lot of American cuisine, eating insects is not really on the table, but there are other cultures, right, where it's more a part of everyday life. Where could we look for some inspiration?
That's right. You know, it's fascinating because, indeed, 80% of the world's nations already eats edible insects. And for us, it's really being able to give the opportunity to shift people's perceptions from insects as pests and then really be able to separate edible insects, something that's sustainable and farmed and harvested for human consumption, something that's nutritious, and our focus, something that is also very delicious.
Talk about that sustainability angle before we get to the deliciousness. That's a case I've heard a lot for, as you say, raising bugs to be eaten.
Right, correct. So the UN's FAO, that's the Food and Agricultural Organization, addressed the issue of food scarcity and sustainability and how we will responsibly be able to produce enough protein in 2050 when our population balloons up to 9 billion and we're essentially looking at having to double the amount of protein. Because the insects produce far less carbon emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, because they take far less resources like water and feed compared to traditional livestock, but have a comparable or greater amount of protein by weight. It's something that the UN endorses and really a big part of the motivation behind our work as well.
Now, as a chef, you probably meet a fair amount of people like me who are like, okay, maybe rationally open to the idea, but we've got to overcome, I know, a squeamishness about eating insects. How do you win people like me over to actually give it a try?
Well, first I try to what I said before, is separate the idea of insects and as pests and edible insects. And then I also employ a wide degree. It's almost like just like a huge onslaught of all sorts of different foods. Would you like something hidden, like maybe something baked in baked in a bread, or perhaps made into pancakes or waffles? You don't even have to see it. Would you like something that maybe is crusted, like a crusted fried chicken that has cricket powder that's in the crust? This is really something for everybody, and not something that we're trying to say give up all the other forms of protein. But rather, how about incorporating it into your diet, even once a week, or as an ingredient in your pantry? Because even that kind of addition by a small portion of our population will have a tremendous impact on our environment.
Talking to Chef Joseph Yoon. He'll be speaking in Wisconsin this week. He's with Brooklyn Bugs. He's an edible insect ambassador. What are some of your favorite recipes to make? And let's say ones where we have an idea of what we're eating. It's not hidden in that bread or that waffle.
You know, so there's a very fascinating transformation that I've witnessed when people eat like a scorpion, for example. And I've seen people come in to an event and go, there's no way at all that I will, no chance I'm going to eat that scorpion. But then as they work their way through the menu, because I usually have these like tasting menus where I serve like 8, maybe 12 dishes, and as they work through the menu, they gain some courage. They're like, okay, I tried that cricket gougere, little French cheese puff. I tried that guacamole with some grasshoppers on top. And they build up their courage to eat like a Manchurian scorpion and just simply prepared, torched on top of a wonton with a cucumber, really to highlight the scorpion. And when they eat this scorpion, I've seen this transformation, this accomplishment where people feel like they've conquered their fear. And they walk out with this sense of, wow. And I know that when they are meeting their friends, and their friends are like, so how was your week, Rob? What did you do? They'll be like, I ate a scorpion.
Yeah.
And this sort of feeling and this sort of sense of victory is so transmittable. It's like infectious. And so when people are like, oh, wow, I just saw Rob, and I just saw Judith and Mary. I saw all these guys like eating insects. And it looked delicious. They served it in all sorts of different ways. I mean, I think some of the ways, we're going to be making mealworm sourdough bread with the help of Slow Foods and a team over there at University of Wisconsin. We're going to be having crickets with parsnip and Wisconsin cheese. We're going to have termite juniper wild rice with local rants and mushrooms. I mean, it's really a wonderful array of different foods. Of course, we're going to have desserts. We can't skip out desserts on anybody either. So it's just a really fascinating sort of experience for people to allow themselves to kind of push something so personal like what you eat and what you put into your body, and for them to think, you know, I hear that it's sustainable and it's nutritious. I see the food, it looks delicious, and I'm willing to, let me try this and see what happens. And so it's always like a really wonderful experience for me to be able to have the opportunity to share this food, and we really can't wait to join everybody in Madison tomorrow.
Now, as a chef cooking termites or grasshoppers, do you have a source? Are there people in the United States or I guess, importing who are growing supplies of edible insects?
Absolutely, yeah. So I have three primary sponsors that provide all my products. And so they have just been so, and they're actually donating all their product for this entire college tour that I'm on right now. And so they take great, and in some cases they're farmed, in other cases they're harvested and imported. You know, for each insect has a different sort of story. And, you know, this is on a totally different topic, but blockchain technology may help us have a way to track and responsibly source, make sure that everything is traced and properly sourced. But that's a topic for probably another conversation as well, though.
The blockchain, that's always really easy for me to understand. But seriously, are we closing on a point, Joseph, where a home cook can find a recipe online, find a source for ingredients, insect ingredients, and cook something up at home?
Oh, absolutely. I wasn't sure if I was able to. I'm happy to name my sponsors, but I wasn't sure,
sure.
If that's so. But EntoSense, there are wonderful sponsors that provide me with the bulk of all the insects that I get. And then we have Entomo Farms. They are a wonderful source for all my cricket and mealworm products. And Mercy Mercado for all my grasshopper and gusano worm products. And EntoSense, thankfully, they help to provide a wide range of dozens and dozens of other insects. And they all have online markets where you could purchase their products. And there are also wonderful cookbooks like David George Gordon's Eat a Bug Cookbook, which is actually written in 1998, if you can believe
wow.
it. And there are other cookbooks like on eating insects. That was written by the Nordic Food Lab. And there is a wide array of resources that are available. And a lot of what I try to do is provide inspiration for home cooks to be able to go, you know what, all Joseph did was make some fried rice and add crickets to that. I could do that at home. And so I try to make things that can relate to people so that it doesn't seem so foreign, and things that will be crave-worthy. And then I also try to push the box a little bit and think a little more elevated so that I can also push people who may have a higher culinary acumen who might be like, oh, you know what? Some of those dishes seem like they're right up my alley to make like a risotto with ants and, you know, maybe doing like certain different sort of dishes. So I try to provide a really expansive array a variety of dishes to really show how broad the applications are for
edibles. That's fantastic. Thanks to Jeff Joseph Yoon, Executive Director of Brooklyn Bugs and an Edible Insect Ambassador. He'll be at UW-Madison this week for a three-day Swarm to Table event. You can look it up online, Swarm to Table. Coming up, we'll learn more about the terrorist attacks in Sri Lanka and how to prevent people from joining terrorist movements. That's coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A new proposal in the state legislature would allow pharmacists to administer vaccinations to young children. Coming up, we'll talk with the authors of that bill about how it would work and why they say Wisconsin needs it. First, a terrorist attack in Sri Lanka on Easter Sunday killed nearly 300 people and injured more than 400. Some U.S. citizens were killed in those bombings, including Wisconsin native and UW alum Dieter Kowalski. While the Sri Lankan government is still piecing together what happened, it appears that it may have been a coordinated effort between locals and foreign terrorist groups. Our next guest is here to talk about the attacks this weekend and how the U.S. and other governments can reduce these violent incidents. Farah Pandith is a foreign policy strategist and former diplomat. She's currently an adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, and her new book is How We Win, How Cutting-Edge Entrepreneurs, Political Visionaries, Enlightened Business Leaders, and Social Media Mavens Can Defeat the Extremist Threat. Farah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, looking at this horrible series of attacks in Sri Lanka, one open question at this point seems to be how much was this done by locals in Sri Lanka versus international involvement? What do we know at this point?
Well, the information is still coming in, but the New York Times is obviously reporting that there are two possible local groups that have actually done the violence, but they were getting help from abroad. And this afternoon, we're getting reporting that ISIS has in fact said that they are taking responsibility for this, that their fighters are executing the behavior on their behalf. So, if this is true, then we're seeing a manifestation in Sri Lanka of you know, the so-called Islamic State still taking the role, a very real role in events worldwide.
Have we seen anti-Christian targeted terrorism in Sri Lanka before?
There has been a wide array of different types of violence in Sri Lanka, but the essential point for everyone to be thinking about today in the sobering days after this horrible Easter attack is that we're in a new phase of a worldwide phenomenon where various groups are taking aim at each other in different ways on different soil, you know, and what we should be really alert to the fact that ISIS, if true, ISIS claiming responsibility for this this horrible attack, saying it's in retaliation for what happened in Christchurch, is a new phase of this kind of extremism. And so I don't think one can look at past behaviors within countries or within regions suggesting that is an indication of what's to come. I think we're in a brand new era with new tools and digital natives who are connected to each other, responding to each other in real time.
Do you worry about a feedback loop where a group like ISIS points toward, as you say, an attack like in Christchurch, and then maybe a white nationalist group or an anti-Muslim group points toward these Sri Lanka attacks as a justification or to rally people for future attacks?
What I'm worried about is the call to action of an ideology of us versus them that is present all over the world. And different extremist groups are mobilizing around this ideology. And whoever the us is and whoever the them is may change in terms of what extremist group is actually taking this narrative and moving forward with it. The fact is that they're finding recruits. They're finding a way to advocate what they believe in and moving that towards violence, which is a very serious change in what we're dealing with today. Because when we were looking at the ideological threat of groups like the so-called Islamic State or Al-Qaeda or Shabab or the Taliban, we had not actually included in that strategy, in fact, the rise of white supremacist movements as well, and the fact that there could, in fact, be a ping-ponging here where one group is doing one thing, one is retaliating for another. And I think we really need to be very conscious of this change and understand what could happen next.
That seems like it makes it very difficult to prevent this kind of terrorism if, regardless of where someone is in the world, they can point toward a manifesto from Norway, an ISIS video on YouTube as their motivation. That transcends national borders. How do you start to prevent that kind of inspiration and then attacks?
I think wringing hands and suggesting that there's no way out is not the answer. In fact, solutions are available and they are affordable right now. We have spent 20 years since 9/11 market testing various programs and initiatives in small ways, it is true, but it is time to scale what we know works to stop young people from finding the ideology of us versus them appealing. And those programs have been tested in an offline space and in an online space. And it is really outrageous that here we are in the days after this vile attack in Sri Lanka, still having the same kind of conversations we had after 9/11. This is too complicated. It's too hard. There's nothing we can do. In fact, there's a lot we can do right now. The solutions that I talk about are real. They have been, they can be deployed right this moment. What we don't have is leadership to make that happen.
We're talking to Farah Pandith about the attacks in Sri Lanka and about wider issues of preventing future terrorist attacks. Farah, have we had too much of the United States and other world governments had too much of a reactive stance? We, after the last attack, try to figure out how to prevent exactly that same attack in the future.
Well, we've been lazy on hate, period. We are watching the rise of hate grow in various ways around the world, and everybody looks to the other as the entity that's going to deal with the problem. This is something government needs to do. This is something, you know, a faith group needs to do. This is something that, you know, pick your organization that should take this on. In fact, fighting hate requires all of us to go in, to take it seriously. It's a choice that we have to make. And what I have absolute belief in is that all this time post 9/11, where we have talked about this issue, I know that there is a way forward that requires us to come together and build the kind of machine 24/7 that is going to actually work on stopping recruitment of all kinds. And it is not something that is so challenging. What's challenging is the leadership and the kind of commitment that it's going to take from the private sector and from citizens themselves to say this is something we believe in.
Now, you talk about these issues in your new book, How We Win, and I'm hoping we'll have you back on to spend some more time on the book. But in general, now that the world is watching after the Christchurch attacks, after these attacks in Sri Lanka, how would we put into practice some of the things you are looking for to keep people from being recruited to these movements into the first place?
Well, the first thing to do, absolutely, is to say we're going to do something about it and actually take what we have learned in the last 20 years and scale it. We don't even have to build anything new. At this moment, we have market tested all kinds of programs that are available to us right now. The money that needs to come to actually allow them to scale can come from government, they can come from the private sector, and it can come from philanthropy. So if we do nothing else but scale what we already know is happening right now, we would be in a much better situation than we are.
Can you give us an example of one of those market-tested programs that might prevent people from being lured in by extremism?
Absolutely. So we know that former extremists actually have the most legitimacy in telling a young person why they shouldn't join an extremist group of any kind, using and curating their content so that it is deployed in ways that feel comfortable and authentic to a young person who absorbs it. So a video, an exchange where they're watching and talking with somebody who is a former extremist online, where they are learning what the bad guys do to dupe you. These are all things that we can actually spread and reshape how communities understand what the bad guys are doing and using former extremists to do it because they're the most authentic. The Against Violent Extremism Network that was built almost 15 years ago now, that network has about 300 former extremists that are part of it. Why are we not deploying their content in new ways? Why are we not working with cultural listeners and social listeners who actually market jeans and sneakers to us and help us take their content and put it in front of young people to help them understand what that us versus them ideology is doing and how it is corrupted? We haven't even thought about the kinds of ways we can bring back the narratives of former extremists who are also in the camps, the foreign fighters that have come back from ISIS, that have stories to tell, that can tell us what, in fact, the lies that ISIS told and what was the reality on the ground. We haven't taken their stories and done anything with it to actually showcase, how they've been duped. So, in fact, what we have available to us is right in front of us. But we haven't had the capacity to actually take this stuff and do anything with it.
What do we know about what lures a young person, in most cases, I think a young man, into joining a group, either online or in person, that's going to do something horrible, whatever the motivation, white supremacy, Islamic terrorism, whatever it might be? What is it that the young man gets out of that?
Listen, the most important thing to understand in terms of the system that is underlying extremism is that we no longer have our finger on the pulse of what's going on. And the young people who have grown up post 9/11 are dealing with a crisis of identity. And this issue of identity and belonging is at the core of how the bad guys are able to prey upon these young people and pull them in. So when you're asking questions about what does it mean mean to be a real, you know, Muslim? What's the difference between culture and religion? And a group like ISIS is providing answers to those young people in ways that are culturally savvy and are generationally appropriate. They have a step up on us, and we haven't done the same thing.
We'll leave it there for now, but for I hope we can talk to you again. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Farah Pandith is a foreign policy strategist and former diplomat. She's currently an adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. She joined us today to talk about the terror attacks in Sri Lanka over the weekend and anti-terror efforts around the world. Here's a question. What's the one household chore that you wish a robot could do for you? If your answer was fold the laundry, one, you're probably not alone. And two, I got bad news for you, cousin. A company that made a big splash with a robot that folded laundry has folded itself, filing for bankruptcy. As reported in Gizmodo, the Japanese company Seven Dreamers has been a hit at technology trade shows with their Laundroid prototype. How is it supposed to work? You feed in one piece of laundry at a time, and the Laundroid folded it. Well, what went wrong? One, it turns out that folding laundry in all different shapes and sizes is actually pretty hard for a robot, and word on the street is that Laundroid was just not very good at folding. Two, even when it could fold the Laundroid was very finicky about how you fed each piece into the system. Now, I probably could have used something like this. I'm a very bad folder of all articles of clothing, and to where, you know, not just it looked bad in the drawer, but where it kind of would show in the wearing of the clothing, all the wrinkles and lines and things like that. And then there's the fitted sheets. A robot that could fold fitted bed sheets would be pretty cool. On the other hand, where do the fitted sheets live when they're not on your bed? In the closet. Nobody sees them. Who cares how they're folded? This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.